Brenda, does being a woman essayist have any particular significance for you? Would you say gender has influenced the shape of your career or your writing?
Yes, I think it does have an effect, especially in the types of forms that I choose. I get the descriptor quite a bit that my work is quiet, and in a way, I think that might have something to do with gender, that more quiet, less assertive voice that comes through in most of the writing that I do.
Would you say that it has had any effect in your institutional relationships? I'm thinking as a student with teachers, or in getting a job, or perhaps in publishing and editing, not so much with your style, but with just the sort of career dealings?
Not that I know of. It's not something that I've been that aware of throughout my career. I do have a sense of myself in the editing world, because I'm the editor of the Bellingham Review, and there don't seem to be that many female editors of literary journals. Mm-hmm. And so I am aware of myself as a woman creating the voice of this journal as well.
How has that become apparent to you, that there aren't many women in the editorial field at the helms of journals? And I don't know if you have any thoughts about why that happens.
Yeah, I'm not sure why that happens, because certainly in the writing world, it's probably quite proportional, of course. But it seems that in editorial work, men seem to take on those leadership roles more than women. Now, of course, I'm generalizing here. I haven't done a formal study,
no,
or,
the study
or anything,
would,
but just in my anecdotal experience of being a writer and submitting to literary magazines, and the editors that I meet at conferences, for the most part, they're men. And the women I have met, Hilda Roz does Prairie Schooner, and she's been doing that for years and does a marvelous job with that magazine. And Seneca Review, Deborah Tall, who recently passed away, it's a great loss to our community.
Yeah. Do you think that you've published more women? I mean, have you kept track or even noticed whether you had any predilection for publishing women?
I have not kept track. I do not know. That would be interesting to look at.
I mean, I don't know. It seems to me that there are more women in graduate school.
Hmm.
Than men.
Well, certainly my classes, the proportion is always skewed towards women.
And yet then, if you look at the rate of publication,
mm-hmm.
women do not publish as frequently in magazines,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
You wonder why.
Hmm.
Why that happens.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't think there's been any kind of study being done.
Yeah.
As the editor of the Bellingham Review and as an essayist yourself, would you say could you talk about the kinds of things you look for as the hallmarks of the kinds of essays you'd like to publish?
We tend to go for work that is a little more quirky than your average bear, and we really like work, especially in nonfiction, that is using form quite consciously, in the lyric essay forms especially. So we do tend to gravitate more towards that kind of experimental work, especially in the nonfiction. And poetry, we tend to have a real mix of, you know, just straight narrative poems right alongside lyric experimental poems. And I'm kind of proud of that, and yet they still seem to have a consistent voice that fits in with the voice of the Bellingham Review.
Do you feel any particular call to publish new writers?
Yes, definitely.
And how do you implement that as an editor? How do you balance out perhaps receiving submissions from writers you know,
mm-hmm.
or are well known to you,
mm-hmm.
either one,
mm-hmm.
and writers you don't know at all?
Well, we just give everybody an equal chance. I hope that we do. It's always hard to say how your biases get in the way. But I think our contests also create a pretty equal playing field because we read completely anonymously for all three contests. We have the Annie Dillard Award in Creative Nonfiction and the Tobias Wolff Award in Fiction and the 49th Parallel Poetry Award. And it's a very complex process, but we do keep all of the submissions completely blind until we have picked the 10 finalists. And then we know who the finalists are, but we send the finalists to the celebrity judge completely anonymously as well. So at that point, you know, it doesn't matter what your background is, what your credits are, it's all about the quality of the voice that rises to the surface. And I'm always so pleasantly surprised at the end. I'm always so nervous that we won't find anything that we like, and then we always come across the most marvelous pieces in the contest, and really the majority of the work I do publish ends up being finalists from the contest.
Okay. And so you would say that you're quite pleased with the selections the judge has made when you...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. That's yeah, we don't send anything over to the judges that we wouldn't be happy to publish as well.
And so you tend to publish the finalists or some of the finalists if they didn't win.
Yeah. Yeah, because usually if they've made it that far, the work is pretty high quality.
Okay. Yeah. What are some of the most important developments or innovations in contemporary literary nonfiction from your point of view that you see? I mean, you're both a writer, a teacher, and an editor, and that gives you something of a special purchase on seeing a wide range of the writing that's being done. Mm-hmm. What would you say you see as the future and the developments in the form?
I think what I'm seeing, of course, this is my bias, but I think I am seeing the lyric essay becoming much more of a mainstream form. It's not such a big deal anymore to see a segmented or a braided essay. And so in a way, people are now creating more innovations beyond that as well. And I think I'm seeing, and I could be making this up because I want to see it, more of a sense of social responsibility in the work, even if it's a personal essay, the sense of the writer being a witness to the world, even if it's a witness not to something, you know, horrendous like war, but just being a witness to everyday experience and giving voice to those who have not had a voice before.
Just speaking personally, what writers would you say have been, who do you admire particularly in their innovations in the essay form?
Well, I really like Leah Purpura's work. I think, you know, she's very brave in how she approaches form and language, and she's a poet. So a lot of the poets come to prose without a lot of the constrictions that perhaps people who have only written prose might feel about their work. I'm a big fan of Mark Doty's prose as well. See, I'm mentioning all the poets, right?
So you would say, perhaps, that you are particularly feel a kinship with poets who come to prose.
Right, right, exactly.
Yeah. I know this is a horrible generalization, perhaps, but would you say that sometimes fiction writers, or those who come with perhaps a more fictional background, are perhaps more long-winded, or try to expand, don't have a sense of economy as much as a poet? I mean, is it partly the sense of the economy of a poet's language and approach to the form that you particularly appreciate?
No, because both poets I just mentioned, their essays are actually quite long, and it's not, but they don't feel long-winded. I think what I sense with fiction writers who come to prose, and if it's not to essays, and if it's not successful, it often is successful, but if it's not, I think it's because they are trained to tell a story. And when they turn their attention from a fictional story to a non-fictional story, there's not as strong a sense of plot, but they still just create the story even with that weak sense of plot. And so the resultant essay tends to just not have a real strong oomph to it or core or something else besides the ostensible story that they're telling. And the essays that I'm attracted to are always writing about something bigger or another layer on top of the narrative layer. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking that's what I'm seeing if a fiction writer is coming to essay for the first time, perhaps, and not really aware of how it is so different than writing a fictional story.
Okay. Does research play any role in the literary nonfiction writing that you do? And if so, is there a particular example you could talk about where research did play an instrumental role in the composition?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, more and more it's become more instrumental in my work, because I've gone from being as introspective as I was in my first book to being a little more extrospected, I guess is the word, and turning my gaze outward. And so usually my essays now start not with some personal story that I feel I need to tell, but more with something I've observed in the world, and it gets my attention. And so I start researching it and seeing where it leads. So an example of that is an essay that right now is called Rejuvenation, that is about stained glass art, and basically just started with me buying some stained glass for my new home and then realizing I've always been attracted to that particular art form. So I started researching Tiffany and I started researching Chagall and their work in stained glass, and through that research and just stained glass itself and the processes that make stained glass. And when you do that kind of research, you usually come up with some beautiful metaphors that arise out of the research. And especially when you're so caught up and immersed in research, then all these other things that you observe in the world just start magically connecting in as well. So, of course, with a stained glass essay, I'm creating a fragmented piece that is meant to mimic the process of stained glass as well.
And is there a personal thread that runs through that essay as well?
Yeah, the personal, I mean, I didn't know what it was until I started putting it together, but there's this sense of brokenness and the sense of how I'm actually attracted more to art and to work that foregrounds their brokenness rather than their wholeness, and the sense of being put back together and still having the lines show that there isn't some perfect smooth surface that you've been affected by that brokenness.
That's interesting. Are there other topics in that you've been writing about that would fall into that category of, for instance, other artists or types of art? Or is the stained glass one kind of unique in what you're doing?
That one was unique unto itself, but there have been several pieces that have been started around some artwork, like Franz Marc I've been writing a little bit about, and of course now I'm drawing a blank, but there's been a lot of music essays. A lot of the current essays I'm writing have to do with how I see spirituality emerging through art.
Okay. I wanted to ask you, since you have agreed that Season of the Body is, in a sense, a spiritual autobiography, or at least could be understood at least at one level as a spiritual autobiography. Are there other spiritual autobiographies that you would recommend? What are the particular challenges that accrue to writing a spiritual autobiography in terms of finding a home, a publication home, and some of the kinds of conventions that you do or do not like that seem to accrue to that form?
Well, some of the writers that I read recently to put together a syllabus on writing spiritual autobiography were, of course, André Debus is one of my favorite writers. And he's a fiction writer, but his essays are so wonderful. And they're about brokenness. I mean, he had a horrible accident where he is in a wheelchair, and but he's such a strong Catholic as well. So his essays are so much about reconciling all of that in such passionate language. Brian Doyle is an essayist from Portland who is just so exuberant in his work, and I just love his sense of play and language. Mark Salzman with Lost in Place, the book that we read, with his humor and the way he approaches things. So, I'd say the biggest challenge, of course, is finding your own unique language to talk about these issues that are so washed in cliche and rhetoric and can be preachy and that kind of things. Sentimentality is a big danger. So really looking at how writers you admire manage to avoid those traps, and it's usually through just a strong grounding in personal story, your own experience, and using very strong, concrete details to get that across. Mm.
Is Brian Doyle primarily a writer, or does he wear other hats as well?
Yeah, he's also the editor of Portland Magazine.
Right, I did know he was that. And is that a general magazine, or is that...
It's a Catholic magazine.
Magazine. And and do they have a kind of publishing agenda of any sort?
Well, it's the Portland University magazine, so it's very much based on the philosophy of that religious institution.
Okay. It's just a little side note.
Yeah.
And what do you think of... I mean, would you call Annie Lamont?
Yes, and Annie Lamont, of course, is wonderful.
Would you?
Yeah.
You do? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, she's fantastic.
Okay.
Yeah, and the students really love her, too. Of course, the humor is what really, you know, makes that rise above a lot of those pitfalls, too. Mm-hmm. And that really sincere questioning of the self, not being sure of who you are and what you believe and having it change, you know, and just not having that certainty. I think that certainty is what can also lead to pedanticism.
Just one last question on that. Are there any limitations when you choose to write spiritual essays or autobiography of any sort in publishing, or do you find that those can be published just as any other topic or subject?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
And it's better. There's certain magazines that are geared towards that. There's Image Magazine out of Seattle Pacific University, which is a wonderful. It encompasses a lot of different kinds of spirituality. The Sun magazine, you know, really likes a lot of that kind of work. And there's one I'm thinking of that does a lot of the mythology. What is that called? It starts with a P. Do you know what I'm talking about? And they always have a theme in their issues.
I'm not sure, but I noticed that you have had essays, or some of your essays from Season of the Body appeared in The Sun. Have you published an Image?
No, not yet.
As well. That's a magazine that I think has more currency on the West Coast. I know of it, but in the Midwest, you know, one of the things that is very frustrating is the disappearance of literary magazines and bookstores. Is that happening in Seattle?
Well, I don't know about in Seattle, but in Bellingham, it's hard to even find them in our independent bookstore. But we do have a wonderful newsstand that has a whole aisle of literary magazines, so I'm always there browsing.
Yeah, because I noticed that Schuller's has recently dropped. The only literary magazine I saw on the shelf was American Scholar. And they used to have, you know, more. And it's just, it's rather sad. Are there any particular literary magazines that you read with great interest and would like to have your work read in them?
Yeah, I read a lot of literary magazines. I can say I read them cover to cover.
Sure.
But I skim a lot of them. We get a lot of them into the Bellingham Review office. And, you know, the Georgia Review is always good. And I really love Waterstone out of Hamline University. It's they only come out once a year. But it's this big volume, and everything in it just seems good. And Fourth Genre from Michigan State is one of my favorite magazines, because of the variety of nonfiction that they publish. I'm really appreciative of their wide, inclusive definition of creative nonfiction.
What do you need for your writing to flourish?
I need people who will support me in doing my writing, who are waiting to see my writing. And I need, I say time, but it's not, time isn't so much the issue. It's having that space in your mind to actually do work of that nature, and to just quiet down enough and calm down enough to have that time. It's very easy to get caught up in being busy and having so many things to accomplish.
So having you really depend on people wanting to see what you are writing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you say that, do you mean friends or mm-hmm. colleagues or a larger sense of editors, public, you know, people across the country?
When I said that, I meant friends, but I think, as I think about it, I really think just this sense of having an audience out there who cares about my work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, even though when you started, you didn't know whether you would have any audience at all.
No.
So is this a change?
Yes, I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. A related question is the issue of time and quieting down your mind, because you are a teacher and an editor and a writer. How do you balance those hats, and do they sort of nourish one another, or can it become kind of a combat zone?
It becomes a combat zone, I'm afraid. Yeah, at sometimes it can be nourishing, especially if I commit to doing the work I'm asking my students to do. But I don't always commit to that. So most often it becomes a battle to compartmentalize my life just a little bit more.
Okay. Well, thank you, Brenda.
Well, thank you, Marcia.